Welcome to the final episode in our World War II series, where we will focus on Magnus Hirschfeld. Finally. We did this series a little bit out of order when compared to the articles done by Laura. This started out as a fault of my own distractibility, then evolved as I continued to do research for my episodes. See, in nearly every episode I've done so far, Magnus has made an appearance. He was so prevalent in the queer community during World War II that it is impossible to ignore him. Thus, I thought we could use him as a way to wrap up the series, given that he's already contributed to the lives of so many of the people we've already discussed. Basic business rundown, per usual. Laura is out again this week and could really, really use some financial help. If you have a dollar, feel free to visit our one-time donations page. You're also more than welcome to become a queer history patron. Our rewards are sweet, and you all seem to like the articles well enough. Finally, if you're interested in writing an article for Queer History or just talking to us, go ahead and email Laura or I at queerhistorypatreon@gmail.com. Now, it's hard to find a place to start with Magnus. He was born in 1868 to Jewish parents. His motto, as he grew older, became "Through science to justice," indicating that he preferred empirical evidence to theories. Journalist Peter Tatchell claims that, while Hirschfeld always had a fascination with the act of sex, it was his guilt when witnessing the treatment of a gay man by the medical community that prompted him to start working towards his Institute of Sexuality. It was in 1897 that Hirschfeld used his scientifically oriented brain to reach out to others, founding the Scientific Humanitarian Committee. For those Les Mis fans, the queer community in France around this time had taken up the battle cry, "Liberté, fraternité, égalité, homosexualité." Hirschfeld, however, did his best to keep a level head. It was due to his efforts with the SHC that, as mentioned in our first episode of the series, paragraph 175 in Germany was repealed in 1898. Hirschfeld couldn't present its reinstatement several years later, but he did promote some of the first steps Germany took towards LGBT+ equality. The breadth of the scientific and political work Magnus did over his lifetime has been noted across the board. He enabled the first sex affirmation surgery recorded in history, then assisted with many of Lily L's transformative surgeries. He opened up his institute and provided not only medical care for the queer community, but housing for impoverished members. He also promoted women's rights over the course of his life, enabled women to get abortions at the institute. According to Mills, Hirschfeld didn't believe in the binary of genders or sexualities, but believed there was a wide range of identities, recording up to 64 in his research. Does this mean that Hirschfeld was perfect? No, in no way. Mills states that Hirschfeld's politics were aggressive, even dangerous, and that he was incorrect in many of the theories he reported. There is even a quote from Alex Ross of The New Yorker saying that, "Hirschfeld had enemies in Berlin's gay scene. His interest in effeminacy among homosexual men, his attraction to lesbianism, and his fascination with cross-dressing among both gay and straight populations offended men who believed that their lust for fellow males, especially for younger ones, made them more virile than the rest of the population." We at Queer History are not looking to deify Magnus Hirschfeld. We simply want to explore who he was as a person and how he fit into the queer community. It's obvious that while he was a great boon, some in the community and many in the government found him to be an unwelcome inclusion. This, however, restricts our view to Magnus's professional life. Magnus's personal life revealed that he, like so many other people he researched, was gay and engaged in a polyamorous relationship with Li Shutong and Carl Giese. Li Shutong, also known as Tao Li, met Magnus while Magnus was visiting Shanghai, and the two men seemed to have begun their relationship there. There's not a lot of information out there about Li Shu, and everything that does exist details his life post-Magnus instead of pre-Magnus. The two of them traveled the world together, with Li acting as Magnus's Chinese interpreter. According to Ron Dutton, the attraction must have been immediate, mutual, and profound. Days after his arrival in Shanghai, Hirschfeld left for Beijing with Li now as his traveling companion. The two returned to Berlin shortly after the institute had been destroyed. When Magnus fled Berlin for France, Li accompanied him, and they were soon joined by Magnus's other lover, Carl Giese. Carl Giese was born in 1898 and was in school when he and Magnus met. Giese served as Magnus's secretary and as the head of the Institute's archive. His Wikipedia page is primarily in German, and there are a few sources that discuss him in great detail, but according to Ron Dutton, Carl Giese was 22 when he first heard Hirschfeld's lecture in 1920, and he quickly moved into Hirschfeld's rooms at the Institute, where he gained the affectionate title of, quote, "woman of the house." Magnus left both Carl and Lee a significant amount of his work and his money after his death in 1935. Neither man seems to have gotten much, though the circumstances of this prevention are made to seem unclear. The relationship between these three men, however, seems to have been based in intelligence. Ron Dutton says that, in Paris, after a bumpy period of adjustment punctuated by fits of jealousy, the three settled into an uneasy but lasting ménage à trois until Gisset was forced by a certain bathhouse affair to hurriedly relocate to Vienna, then Brno. Thus, we have a picture of not only Magnus's work, but also his personal connections to the LGBT+ community. He is scattered throughout World War II's queer history. Even with his flaws, it's undeniable that he helped lay the groundwork for the LGBT movement that lives on today. Magnus's work and his love were both controversial, but he never stopped pushing the boundaries of our community's knowledge. World War II began in 1939 and ended in 1945. In the years before it, steps were made to bring the queer community into the public eye, but the work done by Hitler and the Third Reich pushed us back into the shadows. All the same, this series exists because it wants to show how many people like us lived and worked through this terrible, trying time and came out on the other side. People like Magnus Hirschfeld and Josephine Baker were famous during a time when the bulk of society wanted to ignore them. Lily L. was forced to live quietly but still managed to transform her body to match her soul. More importantly, perhaps, are the thousands upon thousands of people within our community who suffered and were subsequently erased from history. There has been an effort in recent years to bring those stories back into the light, but I'm reminded of a quote from an earlier episode. I'm paraphrasing, but one of the survivors of the camps who bore the Pink Triangle said, "The victory was not for us." This quote reminds me of why Laura began the Queer History Project in the first place. We as a community should not have to stand by and watch as we're erased. By bringing stories about queer individuals back into the light, we show people in our community today that not only are they not alone, but people like them have been around for 50, 100, 1,000 years. Our community has survived so much and has existed for such a long time. Historians may try to erase us, but we will keep coming back. Thanks for listening, everyone. This ends our World War II series, so in the next episode we shall move on to whichever article strikes my fancy. I'll likely continue to record articles in chronological order, but as the series has taught me, I'm pretty distractible. Thanks again for listening, everyone. Have a lovely weekend, and remember, history is queerer than you think.